Hey, everybody. Signals crossed one more time. This is Danny Schechter, your news dissector here with Polar Levine on News Dissector Radio.
Good night.
And beginning with a musical salute from the March on Washington, August 28th, 1963.
And I can tell from your applause he needs no further introduction. Mr. Bob Dylan.
Well, that's some history we didn't hear or see much of in the past few days of commemorations on the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Yes, I was there. And yes, I have mixed feelings about this commemoration, given the fact that there's so little progress relatively to report with a great inequality mounting in the U.S. of A. We're going to talk about the March on Washington with Kevin Powell. Kevin was one of the organizers of an amazing event last night in Greenwich Village at the Judson Memorial Church, where there was a big turnout of young people in New York to mark the March on Washington and to talk about all the unfinished business. Kevin gave a really powerful speech there, dealing with many of the contradictions of the march, and he'll be joining us at 5:30. But first, we want to talk about war. What is it good for? Okay.
Absolutely nothing.
That's my opinion. You sum it right up. So there we go. So now we're going to talk about the coming war on Syria, a war that in many cases has already begun with media talking points, with news that the administration is moving ahead with this, even though there's some reluctance on the part of some of our, quote, allies. Joining me on the phone from London, William Bowles, a journalist, a web editor, and somebody who's been tracking the coverage of this whole situation in England, where you may not know about how it's being treated by the BBC. Bill Bowles has some critical things to say about the coverage, as do I. And I want thank you for joining us, Bill. I'm sorry I'm bobbled a little bit here because we missed some music cues. Not important. I know Bill's a big music man, too, so I'm sure he appreciates all of that. What is your take on what's going to happen now in Syria with the bombing, which is supposed to be initiated by His Majesty's government or Her Majesty's government?
Hey, how's it, Danny?
I'm okay.
Good. This whole thing, I mean, I'm looking at it here. I've been doing as much research on the whole kind of antecedents of this story. How did it all start? Where does it originate from? How, and consequently, you know, how the media have played it. And one of the interesting things that I've noticed about this is the really key central role that the media have played in shaping what looks like a coming in attack on Syria. I think it's incredible. The BBC, for example, was really, I mean, in one piece I wrote, I called him, it's a war junkie. But I'm more interested in at this point in time, in how did this thing all start?
And what did
what have you found? To do it?
What have you found? Because what I'm finding, what I'm writing on MediaChannel.org, a piece coming out tomorrow, is basically the public opinion polls in the United States are reporting no enthusiasm, no interest, no support for this war. But if you poll the pundits on leading media outlets, you'd find almost 100% support for it. So in a sense, media outlets live for war. They love war because war creates a sense of unease. It creates a spectacle in which they can show their bravery and their patriotism. And at the same time, it's a great ratings getter because when there's insecurity, when people aren't sure what's going to happen, when our young men and women are in danger, in harm's way, as they put it, there's a lot more tune-in going on. And this summer, you know, there's been a big report of big ratings drops on the part of a number of channels here in the United States.
Oh, really? Well, it's not a moment too soon, Danny. I mean, American TV, as I remember it, was just atrocious, especially news coverage. How anybody knows what's going on outside their city, their state, is beyond me. But anyway, yeah, you know, look, this whole thing, there's a strange thing going on here. Firstly, the story appears to have originated from an Israeli kind of military media outlet called Debka File. Back on the 21st, on the day that the alleged attack, or the attack, which seems to be that there definitely was an attack, took place. Now, initially, Debka File was saying that the attack was Syrian jets dropping gas bombs from the jet planes. In other words, bombing these neighborhoods. That was on the 21st. And then it changed that story. On the 24th, it was a particular outfit of the Syrian army which had fired missiles from the south of the city, and that they'd landed in this suburb of Damascus. Okay. That was what they were saying, and that it was all based upon an intelligence unit of the Israeli Defense Force called Unit 8200, which was, they claim, monitoring Syrian communications, okay? And that they heard this chatter and blah-diddy-blah-diddy-blah. Now
the chatter, let's just point out, they claim that what they overheard were, you know, confusion in the ranks of high-ups in Syrian military who were basically acknowledging their complicity in this attack, something which the Syrian government has denied and which nobody seems to be able to prove. This particular story was examined by the Wall Street Journal, you know, they basically concluded that there's no compelling evidence that this is the case. In other words, the smoking gun may not be there. I mean, there was a smoking gun, but whose smoking gun was it? We still really don't know.
Well, I mean, from what I can tell, there are interesting things about all the reports coming out about the conversation. Let's deal with this telephone or this radio intercept, whatever it was, this communications intercept, which is the basis for everything that has transpired since. It's the Tonkin Gulf, you know, it's the 45 minutes, it's the it's the dodgy dossier, and so on and so forth, all over again 10 years later. Okay, so
he's referring, just for the uninitiated, he's referring to a number of historical incidents when the United States responded to, quote, intelligence, which later turned out to be not so intelligent, if not manufactured totally.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a whole history of sort of what they call black ops or stories being leaked that later turn out to be not true. Mm-hmm. And I think in the United States, there's a lot of doubt because of the appearance years ago by Colin Powell at the United Nations making claims about WMDs in Iraq that turned out not to be true. So there's a lot of cynicism about this. But the Israelis not only revealed this, but they sent a delegation to Washington to lobby for their findings. So In other words, they weren't simply disinterested intelligence purveyors, as far as I can tell, but they had a clear political agenda, which was to encourage this attack.
Well, we got to look at the context of this alleged use of, or this alleged attack by the Syrian government. Because the Debka file story on the 21st deals with something, actually, as far as the Debka file is concerned, which was far more important. And that was a visit to Jordan by, what is this guy's name? Dempsey?
Yeah, Martin Dempsey, the chief of staff.
Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of U.S. Chiefs of Staff. Okay. Now, what was happening there was that the U.S. and allegedly the Jordanians, and I'm sure the Israelis too, were training rebel soldiers, okay, that entered on that same day, on the 21st, as well as before that time, I think starting from the 16th of August up until the 21st, entered Syria, and what they were trying to do was create a buffer zone between Syria proper and the Golan Heights, the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. Okay, this was all going down at exactly the same time. Now, what Debka file were claiming was that the reason the Syrian government used this chemical attack on this part of Damascus was because of this attack from Jordan. Okay. Because at the same time, Debka file were also claiming that there was that it was part of a three-pronged attack by Iran, and that in fact it was all planned in Iran. Okay, there were the rocket attacks on Israel. Okay, the gas attacks and the car bomb in Beirut.
So this is a sort of consistent, if I might interject, with an Israeli basic view, you know, that Syria is behind, or rather Iran is behind it all, that there has to be a war and the bombing in Iran. And so this evidence, with quotes around it, was summoned up to prove this intervention. In the meantime, and unfortunately for Israel, we have a new government in Iran, which is taking a sort of moderate view towards the West and is attempting to make various efforts to demonstrate a willingness to re-engage with the West. I have a little personal testimony on this that might be of interest. Namely, I was invited to a conference in Iran, which would have brought many critics of the U.S. government to that conference in Tehran, and it was canceled at the last minute by the new government. I think they didn't want to send the wrong signal. They were trying to have some sort of rapprochement. But Israel doesn't want that, obviously. Now, joining us also now, by the way, Bill, is James A. Paul, who's been writing a good bunch about this, who joins us from his vacation villa on Long Island,
and has just
come off the ferry to be part of this conversation. James, what do you say? What do you think is coming down here?
Well, I it seems to me that the U.S. and France and Britain are interested in changing the situation on the ground in the military conflicts, and that's why they're wanting to launch these missile strikes. I mean, their guys haven't been winning, and that's becoming a more and more serious problem for them.
So is this
the key to understanding what's going on?
So is that seizing an opportunity here, provided conveniently by this chemical attack, for the United States to intervene, because the forces that the so-called pro-Western forces, some of them include apparently 6,000 Al-Qaeda supporters or jihadi supporters, is not doing well on the ground. So this is an opportunity to change that militarily. Israel believes a great deal on facts on the ground. Has been one of the staples of their military and theory and occupation strategy in Israel. So this whole idea of intervening now, is this why perhaps the United States is rushing to get this done? Basically, even though the UN has sent in inspectors basically saying it's too late. You know, it's too late to hear any contrary facts that might challenge our view. Is that possible?
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that the haste has to do with getting something done before the word comes back from the inspectors that probably it wasn't the regime after all.
You know, Mr. Hans Blix, who was chief weapons inspector for the UN at the time of the Iran wars, has just published a statement in a op-ed, I guess, in The Guardian, saying that this is an illegal practice. The United States has no right to do this, that the, you know, et cetera, and so forth. So it's sort of the same old song coming back again all these years later, as if none of the real facts on the ground are important. Bill, do you agree with that? What's the sense there?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, even if the Syrian government were stupid enough to use chemical weapons, it still doesn't give the US or the UK or for any country the right to go and invade them or to bomb them. It's simply under the UN Charter, it just simply doesn't allow it. I think that it's true that the rebels have been suffering serious setbacks of late. But I think that, you know, the thing at the moment, which to me is the most important thing, is to try and expose this. I think it's a psyops, you know, a psychological warfare operation that's been planned by the US and Israeli intelligence agencies. As you say, you know, as an excuse to go in there and try and take them out. Now, the Russians, there's an interesting piece on Russia Today by a Russian guy called military expert, Konstantin Sivkov, who goes down and kind of catalogues exactly what kind of weapons the Syrians have got and what kind of weapons the Americans have got stationed off the coast of Syria, etc., etc. And he claims that even if they were to use all their cruise missiles in an attack on Syria, it would not degrade their military capabilities to the point at which it would give an advantage to the rebels.
You know,
this whole
model of this sending in so-called Tomahawk cruise missiles. It's interesting how Native American phrases keep infiltrating themselves in to American military practice. You'll remember Bin Laden was referred to as Geronimo by the Navy SEALs when he was taken out. Now it's about Tomahawk missiles. The Tomahawks, of course, is a reference to the war parties of Native Americans trying to defend their land against the American cavalry and the American war machine way back when. So here you have a situation where in the United States today, you know, we're at the end of summer, Labor Day is coming, people are watching, in New York anyway, the U.S. Open. There isn't a tremendous amount of attention being paid, I don't think, to international news. At the same time, when they poll people, what they're finding is that Americans, Republicans and Democrats, don't like this idea of a war. The Republicans are saying, hey, Obama, you have to go through Congress and get congressional sanction. He's not pretending not to hear that. But the public is certainly not interested in it. Robert Reich, the former Clinton-era labor secretary, said, quote, "We're about to go into Syria. I can't tell you at this point how, but the U.S. is readying an offensive. We're rounding up allies, as we did before we went into Iraq. The White House is preparing the American people, as another White House did before Iraq. But doesn't this at least deserve a real debate? The silence in America is deafening. Didn't we learn anything from Iraq, or for that matter, from Vietnam? What say you, James? Have we learned anything?"
Well, let's see. I was reading commentary on the New York Times website, and I was rather heartened by what some of people were writing, in fact. I think a lot of people are remembering the run-up to the Iraq War. And what I'm reading from the press in the UK and in continental Europe is a lot of other people out over there are remembering this too, and that's created a very serious problem for David Cameron, it seems to me, in terms of getting authorization in the parliament.
What I've been reading is that Obama seems to be hedging. He doesn't sound like he's rushing into this thing. I mean, it seems like he's pretty clear. He doesn't want to fall into the same trap, you know, with Powell and jumping into Iraq.
Well, but they were saying only a couple of days ago that they had absolutely certain proof and so on. They're still saying that to some degree. But
well, they never – actually, that's not true. They never actually said they had proof. They said they had belief. They never said that they had proof.
You know, we have a Secretary of State, in John Kerry, who was the former leader of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War and who was spokesperson for an anti-war critique of U.S. policy. We have a president who is a Nobel Peace Prize winner who just spoke.
Undeserved, however.
He just spoke at a tribute to Martin Luther King Jr., who's one of his greatest speeches was his attack on the Vietnam War and the logic behind it, of course, unacknowledged by Mr. Obama.
And his attack on capitalism.
So here we have a situation where the media seems to be going into its playbook, just as the U.S. government is, going back to the same old experts, the same old arguments. New York Times publishing an op-ed piece saying we should do it even if it isn't legal. You know, in other words, it seems as if those establishment voices are being resisted by many readers, you know, and viewers. And now this weekend there's going to be anti-war protests in London and in Washington. And I think that might force the other point of view to some degree back on the news agenda. Not that it was successful in stopping the Iraq
really
war.
Do you really think so?
I think the protests of the Iraq war, while it didn't stop the Iraq war, may actually be slowing down this war because there is...
Well, that's the thing, slowing it down. In other words, unless we are successful, and I think this is, you know, what I keep... It's kind of staring me in the face. Unless we are successful in altering the policies of our government, it's just a question of time before they trash Syria, or rather what's left of Syria. I mean, you know, we talk about invading Syria, but we've already invaded the place. You know, we've already trashed, what was it they calculated? $50 billion worth of damage has already been done to the infrastructure of Syria, which was, prior to, you know, 2.5 years ago, was a fairly well-developed country, you know? And I think, you know, the whole point here about this whole thing is that they're desperate to push Syria out of the way. It's in the way of this grand plan of theirs to corner resources, to corner markets, to hem in Russia and China. I mean, you know, they've been writing about it for years. It's not like they've hidden their objectives. This is what gets me. They've been quite open and quite public about, you know, the objective.
Between the lines, sometimes you don't even have to. Here's the Associated Press saying straight up front, the intelligence linking Syrian President Bashar Assad or his inner circle to an alleged chemical weapons attack that killed at least 100 people is, quote, no slam dunk. With questions remaining about who actually controls some of Syria's chemical weapons stores, and undoubtedly about whether Assad himself ordered the strike, according to U.S. intelligence officials. So even the intelligence community does not seem to have a consensus on all this, but why let the facts get in the way when you have the cruise missiles ready to go?
Well, I mean, this is it, is that having already talked themselves into a corner, as it were, It seems almost inevitable. And I can remember back when, in the months running up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the Americans and the British and all the other pirates had already moved tens of thousands of troops into Kuwait and Qatar and so on and so on and so forth. Now, you know they're not going to go through that entire operation without actually using them, you know, regardless, you know. So
I think it's true that they probably are going to launch a military strike, but I think what's interesting is the changes that are occurring, the difficulties they're having in rounding up the usual suspects to be in the coalition.
The Arab League is saying no.
The Arab League and NATO has refused to kind of go as an institution with this, and the European Union is very deeply split. There's a lot of members of the EU there. So, I mean, when they act outside the UN, which obviously would be the only way, they're not going to get agreement. In fact, in the UN Security Council, a lot of the members there are refusing to go along with a resolution, which the resolution, they haven't been shown the resolution, but they know what's in it. And they're saying, no, we can't do that without, firm evidence from the U.N. inspectors. So
now,
if the Brits put a resolution of the kind that we've been reading about in front of the Security Council, instead of having a vote that they would like, which would be 13-2, it's going to be, not anything very exciting in terms of the results there either.
Well, the New York Times is just reporting, quote, headline, Obama is willing to go it alone in Syria, aides say. I mean, what is this megalomania and this arrogance, which is on the week of Dr. Martin Luther King's commemoration, March on Washington, the Prince of Peace, as he was referred to, and after worshiping, his memory, is now, in a sense, desecrating it. He's willing to go it alone against the whole world. And isn't this the arrogance of empire? Isn't this, in other words, he's got to show how tough he is, not to the American people, but, to his counterparts in Britain, of France, of Germany, Israel. And they seem to be calling the shots in American foreign policy, and that's very troubling. Another story that just came out today. You love this one, Bill, okay? The U.S. commando raid that killed Osama bin Laden was guided from space by a fleet of satellites which aimed dozens of separate receivers over Pakistan to collect a torrent of electronic and signals intelligence as the mission unfolded. According to a top-secret U.S. intelligence document, the National Security Agency was able to penetrate guarded communications among al-Qaeda operatives by tracking calls from mobile phones. The so-called black budget for all of this has been obtained from by the Washington Post, which will give more agita to the president, I'm sure, because all these secrets are tumbling out. I believe
it. That sounds like.
Well, then it's the same thing about this so-called intel that's come from Mossad to the CIA and the State Department and so forth. Now, what's interesting about this telephone conversation is that they weren't listening, apparently, before the event took place. They have only got a recording, apparently, of the event after it's taken place. Now, to me, that sounds really stupid. You know, are these people so incompetent that they only turn on their listening apparatus, at random every now and again? Well, let's see what the Syrians are up to. Oh, look, they've just fired chemical missiles at a location. So the whole thing is ludicrous. And the fact that it's tied in, according to Debka File, it's tied into this invasion and this attempt to create this buffer zone around the Golan Heights, to extend Israeli territory, that is, further into Syria, etc. It seems to me that this whole thing is on the one hand, part of a feint, if you like, part of some military strategy, and the other, of course, I think, is it's a false flag operation, and that's to set the Syrian government up as a pretext for to invade them. And I think it's as simple as that.
James, final thought. Let's hear from James because we're running out of time on this segment.
Okay.
James?
Well, I heard something quite interesting, which was that there were some discussions a couple of months ago between certain military figures in NATO and the UN about after a military operations by NATO countries in Syria, that then the UN would move in with peacekeeping forces and so on. So there's quite elaborate planning for moving in. I think they probably don't really trust the Islamic fundamentalists with this game, and will move them off the table fairly swiftly after they, you know, and when the right moment arrives.
They've got to know that's not going to work.
Is that the plan?
I can't believe that.
I can't believe it. I can't even believe what we're seeing now. How can you not believe it after having seen this over and over and over again?
I'm just going to be the devil over here and say I'm having trouble believing we're actually going in. It just seems too astoundingly stupid. It seems so astoundingly stupid that... Well, I predict we're not going.
It's not actually work,
and it's not going to be because.
Well, guys, I've got to intervene here as your headmaster at this particular private academy, and move on to the next segment. But thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure we'll have more to talk about. Maybe have you back to let's see what happens.
Well, I'm taking James's villa if I'm right,
and let's see what actually happens, whether. Who's right, if any of us are, but needless to say, there's a lot to be concerned about, as was the writer, the author of this song. A change going to come. And I'm playing this song for a young man I met last night who tells us he's not so young, but nevertheless, he was involved in organizing and being part of the group that organized a very moving discussion of the March on Washington here in New York City, featuring young people and featuring people who were at the March on Washington, as well as people who are actively engaged in trying to pursue a justice agenda here in New York. Kevin Powell, KP Nation, my man, thank you for joining us today.
And, thank you so much, Mr. Schechter. I appreciate you. Thank you for having me.
And I wanted to play that song for you. I hope you heard Sam Cooke, because one of the singing groups last night, actually Boys and Girls Clubs of Harlem, I think, sang the Sam Cooke song, and as well as one of Bob Dylan's songs. We opened our program today with Bob Dylan singing at the March on Washington on August 28th, 1963. And the other voice that sang with him, unidentified, was Joan Baez. So that was a really one minor moment. I mean, would have been a powerful moment. People forgot it, but I didn't forget it. And I thought it was something that was really important because there were so many important cultural contributions at the march, as well as a range of speakers, and not just Martin Luther King. John Lewis was one of them, but A. Philip Randolph reading the pledge that all of the people who went to the march took to continue to organize, to go back into their communities, to continue to fight for jobs and justice, not just against racial segregation, but for economic transformation in our country. And you raised some of those themes last night. You were in Washington. You were out of Washington. You were watching the commemorations there. What was your take? Tell us a little bit about yourself first, and then tell us your take on what you observed.
Well, you know, I'm a co-founder of a new national organization called BK Nation. The BK stands for Building Knowledge. And I've been an organizer since I was a youth. As I said last night, my consciousness, involvement in movement work began with the anti-apartheid movement in the 1980s and all the great crazy things that were happening during the Reagan-Bush era that impacted so many of us in this country, all the countless wars. I was just listening to your segment a moment ago before I came on, and it seems like, you know, this happens in every administration, these unjust wars that get launched and these strikes that happen without any thought to peaceful resolution and negotiating. And so that's my life work. From there through work around Hurricane Katrina relief, I've been working for years around racial profiling, stop and frisk, a lot of work around gender violence prevention, certainly because I come from a poor environment. Poverty issues are very important to me. And you know, just trying to, as we did last night, as you saw last night, there's an intentionality with our work, with our organization, to bring people of different backgrounds together, because as I said last night, you know, we are sisters and brothers, and we cannot allow people to continue to divide us, particularly folks that are really about justice and equality and opportunity for all people.
I was there. I was supposed to speak, but I had to leave early. But, you know, very correctly, when I said, can I go towards the beginning? They said, look, it's not structured that way. There's going to be a discussion. So I couldn't stick around. But I'm glad that I went, because what I saw was what we didn't really see in the coverage of the March commemorations, which was so focused on well-known people, you know, on the rostrum, speaking, you know, to the TV cameras. What we saw last night were, you know, young people who came out, who wanted to be part of this, who had a lot to say, who've done a lot that doesn't always get the attention it deserves, and are still doing a lot to try to build for change in Brooklyn, in the Bronx, in Manhattan, in New York. So I think that you deserve a lot of credit for helping to spark all this. You had a very respectful hearing last night, and your speech hit a lot of themes that we didn't hear in the commemoration, specifically the point that you were making about it's not enough to state the problem. We need to state solutions.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I'm sure some of your listeners read the New York Times, and today there's an interesting blog by Charles Blow called The Most Dangerous Negro, and it's about how J. Edgar Hoover immediately labeled Dr. King as the most dangerous black person in America after the I Have a Dream speech. And, I tend to like things that Charles Blow writes, you know, some of the things he writes, but this one bothered me because he was saying that there are no people out there at all who are bringing folks together of diverse backgrounds and working around these issues. And I travel this entire country nonstop as a speaker, as an organizer, and I've been doing so for the past 25 years or so. And there are a number of people like that, but part of the problem is many of us don't get the opportunity to talk, you know, in these so-called mainstream circles. So you see the same people over and over again. So when I was in D.C., you know, I wasn't invited to speak at the march on Saturday. I wasn't invited to speak at the thing the other day, yesterday. And, you know, and I'm fine with that, because I don't do this work for, you know, accolades. I do it for the people. That's what it's about. But you definitely saw the kind of marginalization of either very progressive people or younger people who are out there, as you said, doing the work and thinking towards solutions.
So
what is happening, it's almost like we don't even exist. And many of us have been out there for a long time doing this work since we were teenagers, like I said.
Well, we don't really expect the commemorations to be about anything. I mean, they're corporate media events.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it should – what counts is the type of stuff that you did last night where activists will create our own commemoration of the thing, but a corporate media event is just going to be selling ad space.
Well, you know, the problem here, though, of course, this is about a movement, the civil rights movement, as it was known, the movement. Okay, it wasn't about the leaders. It wasn't about an elite. Yes, there were people who were leaders and who vocalized, but there were organizers. I mean, Bernard Lafayette was one who spoke, you know, in Washington at the rally there. But very few, the people who really drove that struggle, people like Fannie Lou Hamer, people like, you know, who in a sense, have been sort of forgotten, but were the real spark plugs of a lot of the activism.
You're absolutely right. And it has to be that way. You know, even with BK Nation, our motto for the organization is the leadership is us, as in we the people, you know, and whenever, and if you noticed last night, if anyone, we constantly referred back to, it's not one person, it's a community of people coming together. We believe in working in collaboration and coalition with people. We want to, you know, this is why we did it at Judson, because we see the work that's going on there with all the different kinds of organizations that they allow into that space. And we just think that the entire notion of activism, you're absolutely right, Mr. Schechter, it's been completely commercialized and co-opted by certain forces. And the irony of people talking about this man of peace and nonviolence, but conveniently leaving out his very serious critique of imperialism, of war and violence, i.e. the Vietnam War speech from April 4th, 1967. And meanwhile, here we are talking about this country talking about going to strike Syria in the same exact week. And, you know, this is the kind of stuff that Dr. King was talking about, why this country needed to be born again, because there's something wrong with the soul of any nation where you can, on the one hand, celebrate and elevate and commodify someone who's about peace at your convenience. At the same time, you're talking about, you know, going to war.
You see, back in 1963, I was, 19 years old. I was a civil rights worker. I worked full-time with the Northern Student Movement, which had projects going in 8 different cities, including Baltimore, Maryland. Our headquarters was in Harlem, New York, where Northern Student Movement was part of the rent strikes in Harlem, a little bit earlier in 1963. That was a momentous time because there was activism all over the country, people in jail, people being arrested, people being beaten. And so the people who came to Washington, they came as a way of expressing that there was this movement in America operating outside the media. I think you or somebody last night said, well, people didn't see it on C-SPAN. Well, there was no C-SPAN then. There was no coverage, you know, full-time coverage of it. In fact, most of the major media, their whole approach was, you know, all these black people are coming to Washington. They're going to destroy the city, you know. And so Lyndon Johnson, Kennedy had troops in the bushes waiting to contain the expected violent, you know, upsurge of the masses, which, of course, didn't happen. So when I went there, I went with 5 buses of kids from Dunbar High. Young people in East Baltimore, which was one of the worst neighborhoods in America then and probably still now. Reggie Robinson, a civil rights worker from SNCC, grew up in that neighborhood. Anyway, these kids came because they had been politicized that summer. They had worked on direct action projects. They had learning experiences. They put on the play Antigone in East Baltimore. You know, they were really bright and caring kids. And we had 5 busloads of them to come to Washington. It was a transformational experience for many of them. And that's what this movement was about, giving people, ordinary people, a chance to be involved, to get active.
It's clear to me, and you're absolutely right about all of that, is that we, as people who are committed to organizing and developing leaders, we've got to train a whole new generation of folks to do that. I mean, case in point, we've been very deeply involved in this whole situation that happened after the George Zimmerman verdict came down. But unfortunately, because there hasn't been a lot of training, a lot of the young people who are out there at Union Square, and like I said last night, when we marched up to Times Square and they had all this energy and they're like, okay, let's keep going to Harlem, and then they went up to the Bronx, and it's now 1 in the morning, and the police are tracking us the whole way. But, you know, one of the things that BK Nation is determined to do, because we actually are a group of people who all are organizers, we're seasoned organizers, even if we're still, all of us are mostly 20-something to 20-something, 30-something, 40-something, but we've all worked in the trenches organizing, and it's become clear to us that we've got to harness that energy, because otherwise we don't have the kind of thing that you were talking about when you were a youth, you know, which is important. You know, people actually learned how to be organizers. And so now you'll have these kind of emotional outbursts, which are justified. People are angry about the Zimmerman verdict. People are angry about what happened with Hurricane Sandy. People are angry about Wall Street or whatever it is. But how do you sustain that? And we've got to make an effort. You know, we have no choice. And I can definitely tell you that one of the main projects for BK Nation is going to be called the Leadership and Activism Project, which is going to, over time, really make a commitment to preparing people to leave whatever community they are a part of, and not in the leader sense of a savior. I need to stress that. We don't need any saviors. What we need are people on the ground who are just committed to the communities and not addicted to being famous and celebrities and getting caught up and co-opted by the structure that we're talking about.
I have to tell you that after the March on Washington, first of all, during the before the March on Washington, I was in the Northern Student Movement, which was the northern affiliate of SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. But I was also on the Maryland State Committee. There were state committees that planned the march, and it wasn't just one person. It was unions. It was teachers.
That's right.
It was student activists. It was across the board, of black community life, the NAACP, different generations were all part of this. That was its success. After the march, the actual headquarters of the March on Washington, run by Bayard Rustin, was on 138th Street in Harlem. I first met him at A. Philip Randolph's office on 125th Street when I was an editor at the Clinton News, DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx. That's how I became politicized. And after the march, there were community organizing workshops taking place at the march headquarters Harlem. And, a lot of young people were coming out to be part of all of this. And this led to, the Harlem rent strikes, which had 1,200 buildings in Harlem on strike rats and roaches and landlords. And then what happened was, unfortunately, the New York City police engineered essentially the Harlem riot of 1964, mm-hmm. and that changed the tone of the whole movement, because now people were up against, guns and a police force that was using paramilitary techniques of the kind they use today in the stop and frisk.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Now this is what we're dealing with now, because I'm going to tell you, when we marched from Union Square to Times Square up to Harlem, I knew what was going to happen. Sooner or later, there was going to be some back and forth between some of the marchers, some of the younger marchers, and the police, and sure enough, some of them got arrested, And this is the challenge that we face, because whenever you create a movement that's about justice, inevitably there's going to be response and some sort of attack on it. I've seen this in my entire adult life as an activist, but we still have to do the work. We have no choice, because, the only option is to allow these things to go on. And we know that we have to, in the spirit of Sonia Sanchez's poetry, resist, resist, resist. And that's what I'm determined to do.
I love that woman.
Yeah,
what a voice.
To make a commitment to preparing the younger generations to do that, because, I admire people like you, sir. I admire people like Harold Davis, who was there yesterday, the 80-year-old gentleman from Bed-Stuy, who was also at the march, and there were some other elders in the space. And one of the things that we keep saying is that there's a need for a new kind of people's movement. It has to be multi-generational. It has to be multicultural. It has to be people coming together. And, while I do think young people are going to form the backbone of it, because as you know from your years as a young person and my years as a young person, that there's a kind of fearlessness that we have with our youth, that a lot of people unfortunately lose as they get older. But I think that, the danger is to not make sure that the wisdom of people like yourself are not involved in this. That is critical, because that was part of the challenge that I've been facing as someone in my 40s, talking to some of the folks who have been sitting in down in Florida, the Dream Defenders. I went down to Florida to support them as they're pushing to fight the Stand Your Ground law down there, and some of the folks that were marching here in New York, as I said, is, hey, we have to have strategy. We can't just react. We can't just be angry. And one of the things that you just said very critically when you talked about the 1960s, y'all were organizing and you had strategies and you were doing things, and that's very, very important to say to people.
I would also say, we need to have some more empowerment of young people in the media. We need their voices to be heard. I noticed there was a reporter from Channel 11 there last night.
Yeah.
I'd like to see him, and I volunteer, if I can be helpful in any way in teaching some of these media skills. We have this radio show here. I would love to have some young people come up and be on it and learn some of the skills of hosting radio and getting their voices out, because I think we need to give people a sense that they have power, that what they say matters, that there are people willing to listen to what they say. I think, this is a very important thing with a longer term perspective, not just a reaction, not just a protest, but an ongoing, effort to try to, develop skills. When I was at DeWitt Clinton High School, I was on the student newspaper, the Clinton News.
Yeah.
That transformed my life. I became a journalist as a result of that experience. I just made a film about Clinton and my experiences there. So I think that it would be very good to try to create these sort of skills workshops for these kids, because they're very articulate. They're very on, you know, into energy, into culture, into rap, into hip hop, into, you know, music. They have a natural feeling for the need to use all means of communication.
I totally agree. And I would like to, Mr. Shack, to take you up on that offer, because that's something that's very important to us. I mean, particularly, you know, all of us, so many of us from my generation down, particularly are deeply affected by Twitter, by Facebook, by the fact that we all have cameras, we all have camera phones, and so we already are reporters, but the skill sets need to be honed, and we certainly want to work with people and help to train people to be their own media for their community.
I want you to meet my co-host here, Polar Levine, a.k.a. Polarity One. He's a recording artist. He has a recording studio. I'm sure he would be quite open to try to teach interested young people who are disciplined enough to really get into it.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, let's do that. And you know, you have my cell phone, my email address, and I would love to talk to both of you about that off the air. But we're very, very serious, you know, because of my background. You know, not only I'm also a journalist. I mean, I've written 11 books. I started off as a news reporter, just like you. I was a young reporter, and at some point I ended up working in the mainstream world, and I've written for a range of places. But for me, none of that stuff matters if people are not being empowered in our communities. And so I do believe those of us who have these skill sets have a moral obligation and a political obligation to give back and share that with other people. So I completely agree with you.
Yeah, and just by way of biography, I also spent 8 years at ABC News 2020.
Wow.
Doing segments in the mainstream before it became the mudstream and the lamestream media. You know, so I've also had that experience of making films and working with people who meant a lot to me and who I learned a great deal from back in the day in the 60s, but going on and on. And so, I think that there's a lot that we can do. One of the things we did back in Baltimore in 63 is we kind of matched students with tutors who were college students in the Baltimore area who had a one-on-one relationship with young people educationally, and that really helped a great deal. Later on, the teachers' union decided, no, we should be the ones doing it, so they institutionalized the program, and its spirit got lost. But I think there are a lot of people out there who would do something very concrete if they were organized to do it, to work with young people, encourage them, mentor them, and learn from them, because we have a lot to learn. You said last night the leaders are not up here. They're there. They're in the audience. They're among the kids
right.
who are here. I thought that was a great insight.
We have to, and so I want to say to both of you, we're going to start our monthly forums for BK Nation in September at Judson. We're really excited to partner with them, and we're putting it there because we feel like in that part of Manhattan, we'll get people from all five boroughs, from Long Island, from Westchester, even folks from Jersey are welcome to come out. And every month, we're going to deal with some critical issue, and we'll have people speaking, but we also have five projects for BK Nation. There's an education project, there's an art and culture project, there's a health and wellness project, there's a job and small business project, the leadership and activism project. And so, you know, for us, it's how do we utilize the folks that are in our communities? How can we work together in coalition with people to make sure our communities are giving those tools that you're talking about? And so we're very serious about this. So not only will it be the monthly forums, but our website, bknation.org, will be a clearinghouse of information, resources, and services. Because I would be honest with you, gentlemen, when I ran for office in 2008 and for 2010, as you may know, I ran for Congress in Brooklyn, you know, I could not just stand out there and talk to people, as I was told by the consultants, quote-unquote, just talk to the voters for 2 minutes and keep it moving to the next voter, because people were asking very profound questions about help, about where they can go for stuff, and the seeds were planted right then and there. Like, how absolutely crazy it is that there are certain people, as you all know, who are in leadership positions, quote-unquote, who don't bother to provide any services or resources information to the communities because they know that they get to stay in their leadership positions by the community being disempowered. And we're saying that is unacceptable. That is unacceptable.
Well, I'll just say that last night, you know, at the last minute, I wrote you, a little note telling you about my history in the March on Washington, and inviting you to be on this program. Not only did you say yes, but you invited me down, and I'm so glad I went down. So please, Kevin Powell, let's stay in touch.
Yeah, I'd love to get involved.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you've turned us on, and we're ready to help.
Thank you. I'll look for the email from you all, okay. And everyone out there, my email is kevin@kevinpowell.net. You can hit me on Twitter @kevin_powell. But, you know, we are serious about building a progressive, multicultural coalition and movement in this country. We have no other choice. This is what we want to do.
Okay, well, I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, here with my man, Polarity One, a.k.a. Polar Levine, or the other way around. This program will be in the PRN archives, prn.fm. I'll also be having the URL on my blog at newsdissector.net tomorrow, so you can listen to the show and hopefully pass it on to people you think would like to hear it. Thank you for being here. Happy Labor Day to one and all. Remember, that's not really the Labor Day. That was the Labor Day that was changed. The original Labor Day was May Day, May 1st, and for many, it still is. So thank you for being here. Thank you to PRN for having us here.
Now maybe someday.